actually. I'm going to drink a little bit more. Leave the top off so I can grab it fast. So we need perspective. Now, I'm going to give you a situation right now. And I think we've all probably seen a detective show or movie or something in which something like this played out. There's a cashier. There's two customers and two employees in addition to the cashier. The police have finally come on the scene, and the two customers, from their perspective in the back of the store, they say a man came in, stood in front of the cashier, who then proceeded to give them a whole bunch of money from the cash register box, and then the man leaves. That's their witness. That's their testimony. Both of them concur. The two employees, one is on one side, one is on the other, seeing what's going on, a little bit better vantage point. As the policeman interviews them, the both employees say, well, the man enters. He leans against the counter as he passes an envelope, or at least what looks to be an envelope, to the cashier. The cashier looks at the envelope, looks at the man, and then opens the cash register, gives the man a bunch of money, and then, now it seemed to them that he had pocketed that envelope, and then the man walks out. And the two employees conclude this was a drug deal. The cashier says, what are you talking about, a drug deal? Guys, we just got robbed. The man came in, he had a gun pointed at me, and he writes on a piece of paper, and it says this, if I can find it. Yeah, it says something. It says, place all cash in register on this piece of paper. The man takes it, and he ran out the door. And the two employees said, we saw no gun. And all eyes are looking at the man. You just did a drug deal and gave all of your boss's money to the guy? And so the police officer says, let's look at the CCTV. The TV is right behind the cashier. And the man came in with a coat on, leaned against the counter with a piece of paper, not an envelope, that said what the cashier said, and he pulled out a gun so that the man to the right couldn't see it because of the cloak, his his coat, and the man to the left, the man's arm was blocking it, so nobody but the cashier saw the gun. The man got the money, walked out, and while the two employees are accusing their fellow cashier, the man goes free. Perspective is everything. If you have a wrong perspective, you're going to interpret something very differently, many times very wrongly. So I want to get some perspective on this passage. I am aware that there are a lot of different views out there on this passage. I'm going to read it to you, and then we're going to look at it. We looked at it a little bit last week. We're going to look at it some more this week. So follow me as I read the first eight verses of Genesis 6, just like I did last week. When men began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were in the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They were the heroes, the Hebrew there is mighty ones, the mighty ones of old, men of renown. They were famous. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, so that every, if you have a Bible, underline that word every inclination of the thoughts of his heart were only, underline, highlight that word, only evil. Here's another one, underline it, all the time. Every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. What happened to the revival? Someone reading this, so something great was happening just the end of the previous chapter, or rather the end of chapter 4, and now, what? How did this happen? How did the world become so wicked? The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord said, I will wipe mankind whom I've created from the face of the earth, men and animals, creatures that move along the ground, and birds of the air, that for I am grieved that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Now, I believe that there are two sins that are mentioned here that are foundational for why this happened, how this revival of men fully, confidently crying out to God, calling on the name of the Lord, that phrase is used several times in the book of Genesis. Abraham several times builds an altar, calls upon the name of the Lord. It's a sense of devotion of the heart. Whatever happened to it so that every inclination of his heart now is only evil all the time? There's no room for good. What? How did this happen? From one perspective, excuse me. From one perspective, we looked at this last week just a little bit. Angels sinned, and the human women were the human sinners by complying. They never should have done it. Apparently, guess they knew that these were angels, though the text doesn't tell us. Eventually, giant angel hybrids called Nephilim populated the earth so that God had to destroy the world to preserve the bloodline of the Messiah, the promised seed of the woman in Genesis 3:15. Now, another perspective, the one I hold, is that man, and only man, is completely and utterly responsible, not angels, for the flood. And that there are two sins that are highlighted here that we need to look at because those who hold this view right here, I have heard them say or seen their writing in which they look at the two sins that I'm going to present to you that I think Scripture fairly clearly describes for us, but they say God would never destroy all of the mankind for those two sins. The sin has to be something greater. And they cast aside these two sins as something that, no, just couldn't be. Now, that is at the heart of the problem. Because today, when we go through these two sins, you're going to look at them. Maybe you think the same thoughts. What's the big deal? But that's what a lot of people in the church are saying. These two sins, what's the big deal? Well, I tell you what, in God's eyes, back then, it was not. It was a big deal. It was a huge deal. As a matter of fact, these two sins were the primary reasons why the revival fires of God that burned in the hearts of men were stilled, so that every inclination of the hearts of men were only evil all the time. The first view I have up here is the angels, and I explain that to you. Sons of God, both in twice in Job and one other time in Psalms, uses the phrase sons of God, they would say, to refer to angels. I'm not going to disagree with that. Outside of Moses' writing, it was used to refer to angels. In Psalms, it appears that it's used to refer to rulers. Psalm 2:7, a psalm that David wrote, was messianic. He said, God said to me, this day, you are my son. This day, I have become your father. That's even quoted in Hebrews 1. But it applied to David. As the king, God was calling him his son. That would make David what? A son of God. So I understand it. It's used this way. It's also used this way. Excuse me. It's also used in a different way. But this way, this one right here is probably the one that I come closest to. I kind of see both of these, but I'll share with you number 4. That's my personal view. But this one is so open to attack because there's nowhere in Scripture that says that the descendants of Seth are ever called the sons of God. There is no passage in Scripture that calls the daughters of men descendants of Cain. And so this becomes heavily attacked, so many people lean towards this. Let me offer you a different view. We looked at last week that there was a sin discovered in verses 1 and 2 and a judgment for that sin in verse 3. The judgment was exclusively against man. And the only sin that we see in verses 1 and 2 is perpetrated by the sons of God. And I said, from the get-go, Moses makes it clear that the sons of God are men, and they're not angels. Let me also suggest this to you. See, if the sons of God were the only ones that sinned, and then God says, I'm going to judge man, but we don't see anyone sinning in verses 1 through 2 except the sons of God, that the only logical conclusion is that the sons of God are men. Because that's the only people. God never says he judged angels. He only says he judged men, i.e. the sons of God. So Moses makes it clear right up front that the sons of God are men. Also understand this, that this phrase son of God or equivalents, son or sons of God or equivalents, is actually found several times in Moses' writing, the first five books of the Bible, and not one time does it refer to angels. This is significant. I'm going to offer another reason why I'm going to hold to my view and why I think it's important. Angels do not marry. Excuse me. Angels do not marry. Let me find my place here. And in Matthew 22:30, Jesus makes it very clear that in the resurrection, there will be no marriage because you will be like the angels. The most immediate conclusion that's logical is that, well, angels don't marry. Okay, but what else is logical? Now, I'm not saying this is like a go-to, you know, the silver bullet. I'm not suggesting this. But when we think through this, here is my question that I think is very important to ask. Do angels have, are you ready? Do angels have sexual desires? I want you to think about that. And you might say, Mike, come on. The Bible never says, I don't know. Well, guess what? If they don't marry, then they wouldn't have children. So why would they be given sexual desires? That sexual desire would never be able to be fulfilled in the context of marriage. And at least this side of heaven, that's called sin. If you have sexual desires and fulfill them outside of the context of marriage with another person, that is called sin. So why would God give angels sexual desires knowing they could never fulfill them? That's just not what God does. I don't see anything that God gives something that has a specific purpose, but sorry, you will never be able to fulfill this. Now, maybe, like for those who are single, God does create men and women, so eventually they marry, but not all of them do marry, okay? But the intention for male and female is so that in the human species, there's a marriage and there's children. Now, I'm going to suggest that God did not give angels sexual desires. And that's why they don't marry. And when we get to heaven, we will not have sexual desires and we won't marry. Imagine God giving you sexual desires and, sorry, can't fulfill that anytime forever because there's no marriage here, no kids. Do you follow what I'm saying here? And so I think when we hold to this view, because the view says that they were angels, they were doing a great job in their position of authority, and then they looked down and they saw beautiful women and they lusted in their heart. They left their position of authority, became men, and I'm sure continued to lust, married the women, had children. Now, this view goes on to say that those children were the Nephilim. We'll get to that in a moment. But that would mean that angels lusted. I'm just going to suggest, before we really get into the scriptures here, angels weren't given sexual desires. I think that's a fair stance. But it's not one I'm certainly going to want to die on. But I want us to look now at this context, because I explained to you last week that Genesis is a compilation of 10 toledoths. That is, historical accounts. Chapter 5, verse 1 says, and this is the written record, your version may say scroll or book, of the account, that it's the word toledoth, of Adam. So we know from chapter 5, verse 1, that these are written down. So Moses has 10 of these written down, and from them he constructs or compiles them to create Genesis with an introduction, chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 2, verse 3. So we're going to look at the very, the very beginning of this second toledoth. And it begins, this is the written account of, this is the written account or toledoth, written toledoth of Adam, that is Adam's line. Because toledoth many times includes genealogies. Now listen to what it says. See, the reason why I'm going to look at this, I forgot to mention, is because this, whoever wrote this toledoth, this historical account of Adam, penned the words, sons of God. They were the ones that wrote this. So how do we interpret scripture? Find out what the author means by a word or phrase in that specific context. Find out how he uses it in the rest of his writing, and then find out how it's used by the rest of the authors in scripture. So we're going to do that. So the immediate context of this toledoth says this, when God created man, he created him in the likeness of God. In chapter 1, it says he made man in his likeness and image. Image and likeness. That's being reiterated here. Verse 3, when Adam was 130 years old, he had a son in his own likeness and in his own image. So do you follow what he is saying? Seth is in Adam's image and likeness, and he is called a son of Adam. Let me say that again. Seth is in the is in Adam's image and likeness, and he is called a son of Adam. We just read from verse 1 there that Adam is in God's image and likeness. What's the conclusion? He is a son of God. It seems that because he's using this word image and likeness, this is the author's point here, that Adam is a son of God. Now, if you were to look in Luke 3:38, Luke himself calls Adam a son of God. So the toledoth writer understands this idea of son of. Son of God, meaning in his image and likeness. And specifically now, not just all that is meant by the image of God, but character as well. And this is important as we understand now this phrase, sons of God, because they would not include every single human. We're going to see that. Similar phrases that Moses uses, like in Deuteronomy 14, Israel is called the children of God. Now, last I checked, children come in two genders, right? Sons and daughters. So a very fair translation of children of God would be what? Sons and daughters of God. That is the people of God in Moses' day called the nation of Israel. Exodus 4:22, Israel is called God's firstborn. And so it's in the male gender, so he would be a firstborn son. Israel was God's firstborn son. That would be Exodus 4:22. Israel is God's firstborn son. Remember David? David, scripture says, in Psalm 89:27, that verse says that David was appointed as God's firstborn son. Psalm 73:15, now this is outside of Moses' writing, referring to Israel, they are called your, or God's, since he's the one being addressed, your children. Again, your sons and daughters, that is, sons and daughters of God. So in Scripture, sons and daughters of God are regularly used to refer to the people of God. I'm suggesting to you, nowhere in Moses' writing is it ever made equivalent to angels. We do see that in other writing outside of Moses, but not in Moses. Now here's what I want you to do. Turn to Deuteronomy 32. Just going to spend a few minutes because I do want to tackle the application of this. Deuteronomy 32, verses 8 and actually verse 9. When the Most High, that's referring to God, of course, when the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he divided all mankind, that phrase, all mankind in Hebrew literally is sons of man, as opposed to, I guess, daughters of man that we found in Genesis 1. So these are the sons of man, meaning NIV interprets that all mankind. When did this happen? When did God divide all the sons of man? That is, all mankind. He did it at the Tower of Babel, before Israel became a nation, hundreds of years before Israel was a nation. God divided all of the nations. And it says there in the last part of verse 8, he set up boundaries for the people, that is, boundaries for these nations. As they spread out, they settle, and he creates boundaries for them, oceans, rivers, what we would call geopolitical boundaries. He creates them for them, and they have this sense of sovereignty. So he sets up boundaries for the people. Now listen, according to the number of the sons of, now my version says Israel. Give me just a few minutes, just 1 minute right now, to understand sons of Israel. Some of your versions don't say that. They say sons of God. And if you have an NIV study Bible, the footnote says, all could be sons of God. Now, here's our problem. And I'm just going to nerd out a little bit, but I'm going to make it as simple as possible. The oldest Hebrew translations of the Old Testament that we have would be from the Dead Sea Scrolls, written about 2300 BC. That's the oldest Hebrew manuscripts that we have. The Dead Sea Scrolls read sons of God. 1,000 years later, 800 AD, a group of Jews called the Masoretes decided to take the Hebrew scriptures and put vowel points on them. Because at that point, Hebrew, being read from right to left, was all consonants and no spaces between the words. That would freak me out. I can't read that way. Remember that little thing, Nosmo King? What does that mean? It's really no smoking. Yeah. Okay. So the Masoretes had this great idea. We're going to separate the words. We are going to put vowel points so that those who just don't know the words, like the children, they're going to be able to read it just fine. And so that's what they do. The Masoretes have the phrase sons of Israel. Now, I'm not going to go into why that happened. I'm only concerned with right now, what does the original Hebrew say? Because now let me introduce to you one more version. It's called the Septuagint. Septuagint was written about the same time that the Dead Sea Scrolls were. And if you were to look at the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew, do you follow me so far? That translation says angels of God. What? Okay, we're just like totally lost, right? But can I just ask you, what Hebrew words were the translators of the Septuagint really looking at? Because everyone, all scholars know that the Septuagint a lot of times is not literal and it's very interpretive, okay? It doesn't say things literally, it interprets it. And I'm going to suggest they do that here. They do it a lot. I'm going to suggest they do it here. So here's two choices. They were either looking at the phrase sons of Israel, or they were looking at the phrase sons of God. But what they wrote down, their Greek translation was angels of God. Let me just suggest to you. They never would have written down angels of God if the original Hebrew said sons of Israel. They never would have done that. The only way they would have done it was if the phrase in Hebrew was literally sons of God. However, when the translators wrote, the majority view was that angels of God always, excuse me, sons of God always meant angels. We see it in the book of Enoch that we looked at last week that I talked to you about. It was very prevalent. Not everybody, but it was very prevalent. The translators had to have been looking at the phrase in Hebrew, sons of God, to have written angels of God. Now, do you follow? So here's the point. Here's the point. The original Hebrew said sons of God. Now, does it mean angels? If we were to look at this context, and I'm not going to read the whole chapter. If you have time, great. But I'm going to refer to something both before this verse and after. Okay? So if you were to look, now just be patient because it's only going to be like one more minute or less. It says in verse 6, excuse me, let's look at verse 5. They, referring to Israel, because this is Moses speaking to Israel. It's like his farewell address. And he challenges them. He doesn't put his arm around and say, man, I just love you guys so much. Because God's shown him what's going to happen to Israel. And he challenges them to the core of who they are. Wow. Farewell address. And it's like a rebuke. And it says here in verse 5, they, referring to Israel, have acted corruptly towards him, referring to God. To their shame, they are no longer his children. Whose children? God's children. Back it up, and you can read about God. He's called Yahweh, the rock. God's children. Skip over verse 6, halfway through. Is he not your father, your creator? So if God is Israel's father, and they are his children, what is the most obvious conclusion you draw from that? That the Israel, or the people of God in Moses' day, are the sons and daughters of God, the children of God. He fathered them, that makes them his children, and children come in two brands, sons and daughters. These are the sons and daughters. He's calling them, before verse 8, before we're introduced to this phrase, sons of God, he calls Israel the sons and daughters of God. Let's look at afterwards. Verse 18, you deserted the rock who fathered you. You forgot the God who gave you birth. The Lord saw this and rejected them, referring to Israel, because he was angered by his sons and daughters. The sons, that is, the sons and daughters of him. Who is him? God. Right here it says, talks about the sons and daughters of God. So both before and after this phrase, sons of God, in verse 8, it's clear that God, that Moses is talking to Israel as the sons and daughters of God. So when he introduces this phrase, sons of God, everybody knows who he's talking about, and it's not angels. Actually, there's a contrast. with this phrase, when he divided all the sons of man, do you see that in verse 8? And at the end of verse 8, according to the number of the sons of God. So why would God divide all the nations at Babel before Israel, hundreds of years before Israel became a nation, according to the number of Israel? Now, the number of Israel that went into Egypt was 70, just so you know. Scripture says that twice. The number of nations, Genesis 10, that God created out of the Tower of Babel when he scattered them, 70 as well. And so that's why the Masoretes suggest this. But why does God What's the big deal? Why would God create 70 nations? Because at one point, probably 1 year, because the next year, now there's 71. The next year, 73, 77, because they just started growing. Why would he choose to do this? But rather, if it's the people of God, sons of God, the people of God, now here's what God did. He took all of the nations, and he took all of the people, divided them up into nations, and every nation had a representative of the people of God. He divided the nations according to all the people that still worshiped him, so that God would always have a witness in every culture, every nation. If you've never read the book, Eternity in Their Hearts, by Don Richardson, you've got to read it. What a powerful book on missions, in which missionaries in the 1800s go into the various people groups, we would call them nations, and they discover these people groups have a witness of God, a witness of God's creation. The language of China originally was established with pictographs, and you can see Genesis 1 through 11 so clearly in it. Years ago, I've been through some of that with you. But church, every nation has a witness. So here's I think it's fair to conclude. In Genesis 6, Moses very clearly, even in the context and outside the context, he is very clearly saying that the sons of God are men. So what is the big deal? Here's the big deal. Because the sons of men, the godly, the godly men of God looked at all the daughters of men. If the sons of men were just all of mankind, the daughters of men would be all the women. So that godly men, men of God, who had experienced, or descendants had experienced revival, and it was continuing on till their day. But in their day, here's what happened. The godly men looked at all the women and said, man, are they hot. They are beautiful. And they married any that they chose. I want that to just sink in. God said that was sin. And by that, he makes it very clear then that the sons of God were never to just marry whoever they wanted. They were only to marry godly women, the daughters of God. But they didn't. They stood at the altar and said, I do, but continued on with the phrase, but I don't care. I do, but I don't care. Can I just tell you right now that, guys, the woman you marry will have the greatest impact on your life. The greatest impact. The partner, women, same thing. That man you marry is going to have the greatest impact on your life. Your choice about who you marry and spend the rest of your life with is absolutely significant. Now, don't get me wrong. We make mistakes. We sin. Yes. There is also redemption, in which God is able to bring some semblance of correction and be able to make good out of bad. But church, yes, we may even be able to win that wayward wife, that wayward husband. And I can't tell you how many women, godly women, been single so many years. So many. How many is so many? I have no clue. But for them, it means too many. And they settle. My standards just must be too high. I'm going to be single for the rest of my life, and I can't do that. Now, church, I can promise you that probably every single person sitting in this room thought that thought. You may have even thought it when you were 19 years old or 20 years old. I'm still single. Am I going to be single for the rest of my life? We would all say to them, are you serious? You're only 20. But for them, that's 20 years. That's like their whole life they've been single. What if I'm single for the rest of my life? And I can't tell you how many women just say, whatever. And they date a non-Christian guy. Maybe I'll lead him to Christ. Have you heard that one? Maybe I'll lead him to Christ. I'm not saying you never will. It's always possible. But they bank on it, And they excuse their decision now because now they fall in love with the guy and they gotta marry him. Scripture is very clear on this. Genesis 24, 3 to 4. Isaac was not to marry any of the Canaanites, only those who feared God. We see that in Genesis 26 that Esau did marry a Canaanite, actually a Hittite woman, a pagan woman, and it grieved his parents. Deuteronomy 7, verses 3 to 4, where they're challenged, do not intermarry with the Canaanites. Don't do it. We find out why in Genesis 2, in which God says, if you don't get rid of these Canaanites, they're going to be thorns in your sides. What happens in chapter 3, verses 5 through 6? Israel intermarried with the people anyway, and it led them astray, and they began to worship their gods. Church, the person you marry will have the greatest influence in your life. The greatest influence of any person in your life. This is serious. If we now quickly move on to the Nephilim, it says, when, do you see that? the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and afterward, when the sons of God went in unto the daughters of men and had children by them. It doesn't say that the Nephilim were in the land 9 months after the sons of God married the daughters of men. The Nephilim were already in the land when the sons of God married the daughters of men. They were already there. They didn't appear on the scene 9 months later as their children. They were already there. That is Moses' point. So here's sin number two. The Nephilim, and that is who the very last part is referring to, they, the Nephilim, were the heroes, the mighty ones of old, men of renown. Church, here is the problem. The Nephilim comes from the Hebrew word nephal, the causative means to cause someone to fall. It doesn't just necessarily mean the fallen ones. I used to believe that, but Moses never uses the phrase fallen to refer to fallen into sin. He uses it many times, physically to fall or to fall by the sword. So that those who cause others to fall, they're attackers, they're marauders. These Nephilim were conquerors. That was what they did. They were filled with violence, and as a result, they filled the earth with violence. They were the tyrants. They were the ones, not necessarily rulers. I didn't say they were rulers, but they were violent. They were the ones in Rome, they would probably be called gladiators. But everybody loved them. In Numbers 13:33, they're known as giants. So that's why the King James translates Nephilim as giants. It doesn't mean giants, though they are giants. It means the ones who cause others to fall. They're the attackers. They're the conquerors. They're the champions. That's another translation of this word, mighty ones or heroes. They were the heroes. They were the champions. They were the mighty men that everybody looked up to. Little Joey, as a kid, one day I want to be like him, referring to a Nephilim who constantly demonstrated his strength by killing and marauding. They were pillagers. They destroyed people. They were filled with violence and filled the earth with violence. They were huge dudes like Goliath, who was 9.5 feet tall. Og of Bashan, we're told that he had a bed that was 13.5 feet long by 9 feet wide. I don't think that was a tiny dude. And his bed was not made of wood, it was made of cast iron, because the dude was huge. He was a giant. He was of the stock that Goliath was, the stock of the Nephilim. But these Nephilim were the ones who were famous. Everybody looked up to them. Church, can I just ask you, who do you look up to? Because here's my point. The people you admire are the people you become like. Let me say that again. The people you admire are the people you become like. So if Taylor Swift is your hero, the one that you admire, no, don't get me wrong, musically, she's incredibly talented. She knows how to write a ballad. She really does. Not that I've listened to her very much. But guess what? Taylor Swift, at least in her video, very clearly writes at least one, if not more, songs about witchcraft. But she doesn't care. She's extreme left politically. She embraces abortion readily. And there's so many character qualities about her that are lacking. But this generation of young girls, she is their hero. And we are raising a generation of Taylor Swifts. Now I'm going to add someone else here. There are many things that I admire Donald Trump about. There are also many things that I do not admire Donald Trump about. Okay? Just to be fair. Donald Trump, I admire certain things about him, but he's not my hero. I could point to a lot of people that did some great things, but they were adulterers, they were thieves, they were con artists, they were tyrants, but they got the job done, and they did some pretty amazing things, but I don't admire them. I admire certain aspects of them, certain things about Donald Trump I really admire. He has done some things as a president that no other president did or maybe could do, and he was the one who made the decision to do certain things that other presidents didn't because he didn't care about the press, he didn't care about the glory, he didn't care about being a well-liked politician that hopefully his name would go down. Well, maybe he does care about his name going down in history, regardless. But he has made some really tough decisions, and I admire many of those decisions. I don't admire all of his decisions, but there's certain character qualities that he thinks he's the greatest, and that our nation is the greatest. Now, can I say, I think our nation is absolutely great. I believe that with all of my heart. We are great because God created us, and we were good when we created the Constitution, and I believe by his Spirit he birthed that experiment, as it's many times called. And God did some amazing things, and it was grounded in Scripture, church. I think America is great. Its constitution has lasted longer than any constitution held by any nation throughout human history. And that's a fact. I believe America is great. There's a lot of things about America that really are not that great. But America is great. Is it the greatest? See, I have just no desire whatsoever to compare our nation to other nations. I don't need to do that because in essence, we're like that kid on the playground. I'm better than you. I'm bigger than you, and I'm stronger than you. See, we don't need to do that. And I don't appreciate presidents saying that we're the greatest. We don't need to say that. It doesn't go over well in diplomacy, working with other nations. Now, he's the president of our nation, and he is trying to make America great again. And I believe he is, if you've looked at the Dow Jones lately. And there's many other things in which he's taking a stand that Barack Obama took an opposite stand on, and he pulled America right down into the gutter of morals. And there's so many things about Barack Obama that I do not admire in any way. He was a good speaker. Regardless, do you see what I'm saying here? If we're going to admire people, be discerning. Don't just Taylor Swift. Wow. How about Michael Jordan? I mean, Michael Jordan is like my favorite basketball player. But, all right, I don't know enough about Michael Jordan's character. So many basketball players, so many sports figures. Kids grow up, I want to be just like him. And mom and dad are saying, swing the bat like him, but please don't become like him. Because if you ever see him off the field, oh my goodness, will you be disillusioned. They're filled with arrogance. Life is about them. I love it when guys start making a bunch of money, and the next thing you know, they have these charities, these funds, and they're giving so much of it away, and they're blessing mom and dad. And they don't live in this huge house. It's very modest because they're giving so much away. That is a man to be admired. That is a woman who needs to be admired because sports are in both men and women. The music industry, church, we could go on and on. Who do we admire? Because we will become like those that we admire. Be discerning. When you stand at the altar, single men and women here, when you stand at the altar, please don't say, I do, but I don't care. That reveals your heart. You played your card. You married an ungodly woman. You married an ungodly man. And all along you're saying, but maybe one day they'll become a Christian. Well, God says, I hope so too. Sorry, that's very human to say of God, isn't it? But God is saying, but I told you to marry a Christian. Don't become unequally yoked with unbelievers. Come out from that, he says just a few verses later. Church, who you marry, including your closest friends, and the people that you admire, these are the two sins of Genesis 6. These are the two sins that caused all of mankind to cut short the fires of revival because they stood at the altar and said, I do, but I don't care. I don't care if I become ungodly. That is what Solomon said, and he worshiped his 700, goodness, wives, gods. Some of them worshiped pagan gods that sacrificed children to their god. And his wives were worshiping, according to scripture, were worshiping demons. And it said, he built these altars for them and accompanied them. Wow. Some of those altars you could see from the temple because they were on the next hill over called the Mount of Olives. Church, what are your values? Because our values will be seen in the people that we marry, the person we marry, and they will be seen in the people that we admire. Because that person you're marrying, by God's grace, you're going to have children. And let me just say this, men, you marry an ungodly woman, she is going to spend more time with your children than you were. You will. Guaranteed. I don't know what the figures are, but the vast majority of women spend more time with their children than the men do. I get that. There's nothing wrong with that. God created them to be busy at home, and they're pouring their lives into their home, and then they're their children. But if you married an ungodly woman, your children will turn out just like her. And you said at the altar, I do, but I don't care. God said, but I want you to care. Oh, men of God, women of God, I want you to care. I want to close in prayer. We're about to have communion. Maybe we could just I guess Julianne is back there, but others.